Welcome to Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Mark Brumley. Mark is the president of the board of directors of Guadalupe Associates and chief executive officer for Ignatius Press. He's the associate publisher of IgnatiusInsight.com. He also oversees magazines for Ignatius Press, is project coordinator for the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible, and is editor of Ignatius Press's Modern Apologetics Library. We begin part one of our two-part discussion with Mark Brumley, going inside the pages of St. Paul by Pope Benedict XVI, published by Ignatius Press. Welcome back, Mark.
I'm happy to be back.
St. Paul by Pope Benedict XVI. It's a compilation, essentially, of his Wednesday audiences, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically his. He has done a number of audiences on different apostolic figures. He's taking it from the apostles all the way through to the church fathers to medieval teachers and mystics and things of that sort. And what he did in connection with the year of St. Paul, because he promulgated the celebration of a whole year dedicated to St. Paul, he gave a series of catechetical talks or instructions on St. Paul. And so this book is the compilation of those talks.
This is ecumenism at its best, isn't it? Especially when we talk about St. Paul and coming from our Holy Father, who has such a depth of biblical theological gravitas. I don't think I can come up with words big enough to talk about how special this actually is, his insight on St. Paul.
That's a very good point. A good point indeed, because we are coming up to the anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, the beginning of the Protestant Reformation, which was in 1517. And 2017 isn't that far off. Mm-hmm. And so the topic of Christian unity and Christian disunity is going to become increasingly a topic of concern or focus. Not that it hasn't been before. Obviously, for the last 500 years, it's been an issue of controversy. And the Second Vatican Council tried to foster greater unity among Christians without compromising our, you know, fundamental theological commitments and convictions. But Pope Benedict, by focusing on St. Paul, he's sort of laying the foundation for a strengthened discussion, if you will, of issues between Catholics and Protestants, because St. Paul is a figure of very, very great significance in the Protestant world. Of course, he is in the Catholic world as well, but there's a tendency, I think, on the part of some people, both Catholics and Protestants, to think of, you know, St. Peter is the Catholic apostle and St. Paul is the Protestant apostle. Mm-hmm. Of course, from a Catholic perspective, we think both of them, Saints Peter and Paul, are Catholics. I don't mean that to be provocative, but it's interesting. If you look in the early church, the Bishop of Rome was regarded as the successor of St. Peter, but also the successor of St. Paul, because both Paul and Peter were martyred in Rome. And the early church had this idea that in churches where you had these great apostolic figures who were martyred, those churches sort of succeeded in the witness of those apostolic martyrs, the word martyr itself being, you know, the word witness in Greek. Mm-hmm. And so in the Roman church, they celebrated Peter and Paul as the founders, so to speak, of the Roman church's witness to the gospel. In fact, we celebrate the feasts of Saint Peter and Paul, you know, together in the Catholic Church. And so our Holy Father, he launches this book on the basis of that, you know, with the eye toward emphasizing that the Pauline tradition, the Pauline heritage, the heritage coming from St. Paul, is something that belongs to the Catholic Church as well. But he talks about it, you know, he's got a number of chapters here, especially the chapter on justification. Mm-hmm. He says, you know, it's justification by faith, not by works. He talks about St. Paul's teaching in such a way as to show how there's on many issues, not all, but on many issues, there's a harmony between the Catholic understanding and the Protestant understanding, if we can clear away some misunderstandings and misconceptions.
That's just so typical of Pope Benedict's style, for lack of a better way of saying it. I mean, he really brings in all the thoughts, ponders them, filters it out, and then presents them to all of us. I mean, he's very open to listening, isn't he?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think he listens on a number of levels. I think he listens to the Holy Spirit. I think he listens to the community of the church in what its needs are. I think he listens to the world in the sense of trying to discern how to proclaim the gospel. He listens to the scripture, what the scripture has to say, and how to communicate the scriptural message to people. I mean, he is a tremendous listener. Contrary to the reputation that he has, you know, people perceive him as this very dogmatic personality and so on. At least they did when he was just Cardinal Ratzinger, mm-hmm. prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. One of the things you'll notice, not so much in this book, although it is there to some degree, it's not so much there in the book on St. Paul as in other places, because he's really kind of just going through Paul himself. But if you notice some of the other books that the Holy Father's written, he does a very, very good job of capturing the ideas of other people, even when he doesn't agree with them, and summarizing them very well, saying, you know, this is this perspective. And then, of course, when he disagrees with that perspective, he then engages it and critiques it. But he always does so with a kind of fairness. It reminds me of St. Thomas Aquinas when you look at his Summa Theologiae, mm-hmm. and you'll see the way that's structured. He's answering objections to the faith, but he always does so by stating the objection in the most powerful, most persuasive of terms. Mm-hmm. And if you're not careful, sometimes this happens with a student of the Summa. He'll go through and you'll be reading the Summa, and you'll almost be convinced to support the position that's in opposition to the Church's teaching, because St. Thomas does such a good job of stating it.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, you read the response to the objection, then he does a good job of refuting the position. He's just so well articulated. And the same is there with Pope Benedict. He is a man of so much fairness. He wants to hear the other side. He wants to listen and understand, what's the objection here? And how do I present the objection in its most powerful form? Because he knows that if he can do that, the person who espouses that position suddenly, you know, is seen, that he sees that, well, here's somebody who can credibly and forcefully state my position, so I better listen to what he has to say. And then when he responds, when Benedict responds, and shows the inadequacy or the error or maybe the incompleteness of the position that he's just stated, then, you know, he sort of got the person. You know, you've got me. You've won me over. Not only have you understood, you know, the concern of my heart, you've stated it as well as I could state it, if not better, but you've helped me see what's wrong with that position and why it's inadequate.
It sounds a lot like the style of St. Paul.
Very much so.
Who better than to teach us about him than the Holy Father? And he starts out in the first two chapters of St. Paul by Pope Benedict XVI, talking about the importance of understanding his cultural times, what was happening with traditional religion. And actually, it was a time of, can I say, crisis, not only in Jerusalem, but actually around the world.
Yes, it was, because we have at least two, maybe three different cultural settings that are in crisis. We have certainly the Jewish community, the Nation of Israel. We have division there, division over proper interpretation of the Mosaic Law, division over, you know, related point, division over how the people of Israel should understand their identity in relation to the Mosaic Law with respect to the Gentiles. So you got some Jewish people who say, we have nothing to do with the Gentiles, and other Jewish people saying, well, we have to have relations with them. In fact, the Romans are you know, they've dominated the Jewish community. They actually, you know, have made Jerusalem and Judea and the surrounding area, you know, a subject state. So they're under the authority of the Roman authorities. And so, and then you, so you have some people in the Gospels, for example, the Sadducees, who are cooperating or seen as collaborators with the Roman authorities and others. And then you've got people who are radically opposed to that, not just radically opposed to it on a religious level, like some of the more theologically conservative members of the Jewish community, like the Pharisees were, but they're opposed to it on a political level, and they are resorting to violence. The Zealots, for example, resorting to violence to oppose the Roman authorities. And you've got the Essenes, who are kind of a sect living out on its own, waiting the end of the world, where they anticipate that there's going to be a destruction of the Romans and the, you know, the Gentile authorities subjugating Israel, but also the temple establishment in Jerusalem. So this is just the religious diversity going on in Judaism at the time. You've got also, you know, conflicts going on with the Roman within the Gentile world, the polytheistic world of the Gentiles, where they believe in many different gods, many different political ideas and all that going on in the world at the same time. And this is the milieu or the context from which St. Paul, we'll say Saul of Tarsus, Saul, who is a Pharisee, belongs to the Pharisee party, which is a conservative party, you use that term, within Judaism. St. Paul is a Pharisee, but he comes from Tarsus, which is a very metropolitan city, you know, in Asia Minor, where there's exposure to not just, you know, obviously not just diversity within the Jewish world, but you've got, you know, pagan, polytheistic religions. You've got different philosophies, schools of philosophical thought, all that going on. And the Holy Father does a very good job in this opening chapter of talking about the context of the Roman Empire, the context from which St. Paul emerges.
And he also explores the training that St. Paul would have had in, you know, who was this man? And probably, can I say, he was probably one of the most literate of those of the early church. I mean, he was so schooled. I mean, when you think of the fishermen and tax collectors and others, they didn't have the type of theological background that St. Paul had.
Right, absolutely. The Holy Father mentions, he talks about the sort of kind of a dual background that Paul has, and he mentions the Greek cultures. His first, it was the Greek or Hellenistic culture, which after Alexander the Great had become a common heritage, at least in the Eastern Mediterranean, and at least, and had absorbed many elements of the peoples traditionally considered barbarian. So there is this very, very cosmopolitan, educated, somewhat sophisticated culture that is the result of the Greeks or Hellenization that Alexander the Great spread throughout the, you know, throughout the Middle East and throughout the East. And St. Paul is the beneficiary of that. And we can see that in the book of Acts, where on at least two or three occasions, St. Paul will refer to pagan poets. And in the pastoral epistles, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, he does the same thing. He quotes some of the pagan poets. And so it's clear that Paul has been the beneficiary of this kind of wider education that, you know, St. Peter certainly would not have had, St. John, although some people think of St. John as possibly being of, you know, kind of from a little bit wealthier priestly family background, and that's speculation. We don't know that for sure. Mm-hmm. But even so, St. Paul certainly would have been probably one of the most educated, if not the most educated persons in the early church.
The experience that Saul of Tarsus would have is placed in quotation marks by the Holy Father, essentially, that it, he doesn't look at it as a conversion, essentially, that he experienced on that road to Damascus.
You know, that's a very interesting point. I think it's in the third chapter where the title is St. Paul's Conversion, and he uses the word conversion. He puts it, as you say, in quotes. And there's an interesting idea behind that. Certainly on one level, there's a conversion in that Paul went from being an enemy of Jesus Christ and his followers to being not only a follower of Jesus Christ, but one of the leaders of the followers of Jesus Christ. So that's a conversion in the sense of a change, a radical change. But there's another sense in which we can say that St. Paul doesn't undergo a conversion. I think that's what the Holy Father is getting at, in that the faith of the early church, the faith of the early Christians, the commitment to Jesus Christ as the Messiah, as the promised Messiah, the fulfillment of all the Old Testament prophecies, that's not a conversion. You're not moving away from the Old Testament faith or the Hebrew faith or the Mosaic faith. You're bringing it to completion. You are realizing that to which all that has come before has been pointing. So in that sense, it isn't a conversion. And even to this day, sometimes you'll encounter Catholics from a Jewish background who will say, well, I don't really feel like I'm a convert. I feel like I'm a completed Jew. Now, of course, you know, Jews who don't recognize Jesus as the Messiah don't accept that. It's a point of disagreement between them and us. But nevertheless, I think it's true to say that many Jewish Christians today, and especially Jewish Catholics, would see themselves as completed Jews rather than converts, because they don't want to give the impression, as I think our Holy Father does want to give the impression, that there's a radical discontinuity between what's gone before in the faith in the Old Testament and what we find in Jesus Christ.
Once again, I mean, we've talked repeatedly about his pondering, essentially, of all of these texts. And you can tell that when he's pondering that striking blindness, when he is struck blind in that moment, and that it's Christ who brings him the light so he can see. I mean, everything has a meaning. Every action, there's a reason for it. There's a symbolic telling of each of those moments. And Benedict sees it so clearly.
Yes, there's this passage. I think it's in the chapter that we've been talking about on conversion that sort of ties into what you're saying about light and the blinding event. He says, nevertheless, we must not think that Paul was thus closed in a blind event. The contrary is true, because the risen Christ is the light of truth, the light of God himself. This expanded his heart and made it open to all. At this moment, he did not lose all that was good and true in his life, in his heritage, but he understood wisdom, truth, and the depth of the law and of the prophets in a new way made them his own. At the same time, his reasoning was open to pagan wisdom. Being open to Christ with all his heart, he became capable of an ample dialogue with everyone. He became capable of making himself everything to everyone. Thus, he could truly be the apostle to the Gentiles. So there's an important point here. He uses that idea of blindness, that certainly there was a, you know, because St. Paul was a persecutor of the early church. It wasn't just simply that he didn't believe in Jesus as the Messiah, but he was actually out persecuting early Christians, putting them to death, putting them in prison, and so on. And later on, he makes it clear, especially if you read in Galatians and in Colossians and elsewhere, Philippians, that he saw himself as doing God's will. He was a zealot. He's not in the sense of a political party, but in the sense of someone who had zeal for the law of Moses. But it was a blind zeal that didn't see the fullness of the truth. And so when he is blinded on the road to Damascus by the vision of the risen Christ, there is, as you say, a deeper meaning to that, because his blindness reflects his condition of being zealous, but not really understanding what he was zealous for, but that blindness gives way to vision as he's baptized by Ananias, and the scales fall from his eyes, and he's able to see again. He sees and he understands who Jesus is, Jesus' relationship to everything that's come before. But, you know, it's interesting that the Holy Father here says it's not just simply a matter of him understanding Jesus' relationship to Judaism and being open to Jesus as the fulfillment of what the Old Testament is about, but it also opens him up to Gentile wisdom. And there are, you know, hints of perhaps a kind of narrowness that was characteristic of some of the Pharisees with respect to Gentile learning and non-Jewish learning, and that perhaps the encounter with the risen Lord not only transformed some inappropriate or perhaps bigoted ideas that St. Paul had with respect to Jesus Christ as a fulfillment of the Mosaic Law, but even, you know, overcame some of the difficulties that he had with respect to seeing the truth within the Gentile context. Of course, we know St. Paul goes on, as the Holy Father says, to become the great apostle to the Gentiles. And so that educational background and that very diverse cultural background that St. Paul had, you know, the Lord makes use of that, because he's going to be preaching not just simply to the Jews. He does that, as we see in the book of Acts, and not a lot of result, but also preaching to the Gentiles, where he's able to take this message, this fundamentally Jewish message, and communicate it in such a way that the Gentiles can receive it, and do receive it, and then ultimately become the majority of the followers of Jesus Christ.
Mark, isn't it really quite wonderful that in God's plan of all this, for this particular man, Paul, or who is now Paul, he is so learned. He has all the stuff inside of in his mind of how the teachings of the faith and how it should work. And we never know, I mean, it's never said that he ever encountered Jesus outside of that experience on the road of Damascus, I mean, prior to that, that he would have to be the one who would go out to help us to believe in things unseen, because he didn't have that flesh encounter like Peter and James and John that knew Jesus in that way. I mean, he would have to be the one who would help us to understand Jesus in the new way.
Yes, that's a very, very good point. Of course, the Holy Father talks about that in the chapter on the relationship of Paul with the historical Jesus. We don't have any evidence to suggest that St. Paul had encountered Jesus. He may well have heard about him, but we have no evidence that he ever encountered the Lord during the Lord's earthly life. And I'm sure that, you know, there may have been moments when St. Paul, in a good way, you know, may have felt a little envious of St. Peter or St. James or St. John or the other apostles, the other members of the 12, you know, who had known Jesus in his earthly life. But it's clear that, you know, for St. Paul, the really important thing, however important it was to have encountered Jesus in his earthly life, the really important thing is that, you know, he, Paul, had encountered the risen Lord. And this has sort of transformed his way of looking at things. And I think you're right. I think the fact that, you know, he did not have that experience of Jesus in his pre-resurrection earthly life made him sort of adopt a relationship toward Jesus that was in some ways more akin to the relationship that we have. Of course, we've not had a Damascus Road experience of encountering the resurrected Jesus in a vision, as St. Paul did, uh-huh, talking to him and all of that. But we are like Paul in the sense that we are dependent upon the prior apostolic tradition of the 12 and other people who knew Jesus in his earthly life for our understanding of Jesus' teaching and the events of his earthly life. And so that, in a certain sense, makes us kind of closer to St. Paul in that way, because he got his teaching for the most part. Obviously, he got some directly from the Lord in his encounter with the risen Lord. But that vast body of the teaching of Jesus and knowledge of the events of the life of Jesus, St. Paul would have received from the apostolic preaching, just like the rest of us. And In fact, he says that basically at different places in the Gospels, for example, in Paul's epistles, in 1 Corinthians, you know, chapter 11, when he talks about the Eucharist, you know, he recounts what happens at the Last Supper, but he does so based upon, not interestingly enough, the Gospels, you know, because in a certain sense, we've got an advantage over St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
We can go to the Gospels, the Gospel accounts of what happened at the Last Supper. St. Paul didn't have access to the Gospel accounts. But in another sense, he had access to something better. He had access to the eyewitnesses who were there. Now, we have that through their testimony in the Gospels, but he encountered them as living persons. And he says that he's handing on to us the Last Supper tradition, which he has received. And even though he was an eyewitness to the resurrection, 1 Corinthians 15, he talks about him having received what he's passed on to others. He says, you know, I passed on to you, and he uses the word in Greek there, which is sort of a semi-technical term for tradition. I passed on to you, I handed on to you, I traditioned, as it were, I transmitted to you what I received. You know, so, and then he talks about the resurrection appearances, the Lord appeared to Peter, and so on and so forth. So there is this wonderful sense in which St. Paul is both unlike us in that he's a witness to the risen Lord in his own direct experience, but he's like us in that he is dependent upon the sources of tradition, the other apostles and the apostolic witness, for his knowledge of most of the teaching of Jesus.
This concludes part one of our two-part discussion with Mark Brumley, going inside the pages of Pope Benedict's book, St. Paul. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, visit Ignatius.com, the website for Ignatius Press, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and download this discussion along with many others, visit www.insidethepages.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.